of Jesus and Mary. What about them? They're true? Well, I think this might interest you as a policeman. Karras's scholarly interest aroused and stirring. His manner had grown quietly animated. The records of the Paris police still carry the case of a couple of monks from a nearby monastery. He scratched the back of his head as he tried to recall. Yeah, maybe the one at Crepy, he said at last. The priest shrugged. Well, whichever. Some town close by. At any rate, the monks came into an inn and got belligerent about wanting a bed for three. The two of them and a life-size statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary that they carried in with them. Oh, that's shocking, breathed out Kinderman. No kidding. But it's a fair indication that what you've been reading is based on fact. Well, the sex may be so, this I can see. That's a whole other story altogether, Father. Never mind. But the ritual murders now, Father. That's true? Now, come on. Using blood from the newborn babies? The detective was alluding to something else he had read in the book on witchcraft, describing how the unfrocked priest at Black Mass would at times slit the wrist of a newborn infant so that the blood poured into a chalice and was later consecrated and consumed in the form of Holy Communion. That's just like the stories they used to tell about the Jews, the detective continued. How they stole Christian babies and drank their blood. Look, forgive me, but your people told those stories. If we did, forgive me. Go and sin no more, Father, you're absolved. Like the shadow of some pain, but briefly remembered, something dark, something sad, flitted swiftly across the priest's blank stare. He turned his head and looked ahead. Yeah, right. You were saying, Father? Well, I really don't know about ritual murder, Karras said. About that, I have no clue. But I do know that a midwife in Switzerland once confessed to the murder of 30 or 40 babies for use at Black Mass. Oh, well, fine. Maybe she was tortured into saying that, he amended with a shrug. But she sure as heck told a convincing story. She described how she'd hide a long, thin needle up her sleeve so that when she was delivering the baby, she'd slip out the needle and stick it through the crown of the baby's head and then hide the needle again. No marks, Karras said as he turned a glance to Kinderman. The baby looked stillborn. You've heard of the prejudice European Catholics used to have against midwives? That's how it started. Oh, my God. Yeah. This century hasn't got a lock on insanity. Wait a minute, wait now. These stories, Father, like you said, they were told by some people who were probably tortured, correct? So they're basically unreliable. They signed the confession, and later the machers, the pious schmies, and the haters, they filled in the blanks. I mean, there wasn't any habeas corpus then, right? No writ of let my people go? Very true, Lieutenant. But then a lot of the confessions were voluntary. Who would volunteer such things? People who were mentally disturbed? Ah, another reliable source. Well, you're probably right about that too, Lieutenant. Let's forget this. I'm just playing devil's advocate. You do it so well. Lieutenant, one thing that we sometimes tend to forget is that people psychotic enough to confess to such things might also be psychotic enough to have done them. Here's an example. All the myths about werewolves, let's say. So, okay, they're preposterous. No one can turn himself into a wolf. But what if a person was so disturbed that he not only thought that he was a werewolf, but he also acted like one? Is this theory now, good father, or fact? Fact. There was a William Stumpf, for example. Maybe his first name was Karl. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. Anyway, a German in the 16th century. He thought he was a werewolf and murdered maybe 20 or 30 young children. You mean he, quotation marks, father, confessed it? Yes, he did, and I think the confession was valid. When they caught him, he was eating the brains of his two young daughters-in-law. From the baseball practice field, crisp in the thin, clear April sunlight, came the ghosts of chatter and ball against bat.
Come on, Price, let's shag it. Let's go get the lead out.
They had come to the parking lot, and for a brief space of time they walked in silence until, at last, when they had come to the squad car, the detective turned a mournful, moody look to the priest.
And so what am I looking for, father?
I don't know. A psycho on drugs, maybe? Staring down at the sidewalk, the detective thought it over, and then mutely nodded.
Yes, father, right, yes. Yes, maybe so.
He looked up, his expression now pleasant.
Listen, father, where are you going? You want a ride? Oh, no, thanks, Lieutenant. It's just a short walk. Never mind that, enjoy, the detective told him, motioning Karras to get into the back seat of the car. Then you can tell all your friends you went riding in a police car. I will sign a certificate attesting to it. They will envy you. Come on now, get in.
With a nod and a sad half-smile, the priest said,
okay.
And he slipped into a seat in the back of the car while the detective squirmed into it beside him from the opposite side.
Very good, said the detective, a little short of breath. And incidentally, good father, no walk is short. No, none.
He turned to the policeman at the wheel and he said,
Avanti.
Where to, sir?
36th Street and halfway down Prospect, left side of the street.
As the driver nodded and started backing the squad car out of its parking spot, Karras turned a mildly questioning look to the detective.
How do you know where I live, he said. It's not a Jesuit residence hall? You're not a Jesuit?
Karras turned his head and stared through the windshield as the squad car slowly headed for the campus front gates.
You're right, he said softly.
He had moved his quarters to the residence hall from his Holy Trinity courtyard location just a few days before in the hope it might encourage the men he had counseled to continue to seek his help.
You like movies, Father Karras?
Oh, yeah, I do.
You've seen Lear with Paul Scofield?
No, I haven't.
Me, I've seen it. I get passes.
Good for you.
I get passes for the very best shows, but Mrs. K, she gets tired very early. She never goes.
That's too bad.
Yes, I hate to go alone. You know, afterward, I love to talk film, to discuss, to critique.
Silent, Karras nodded, then looked down at his large and powerful hands that he was holding clasped between his legs. Moments passed, and then Kinderman asked in a wistful tone of voice,
Would you, like to see a film with me sometime, Father?
It's free. Yes, I know. You get passes.
Would you like to?
As Elwood P. Dowd says in Harvey, Lieutenant? When? Oh, I'll call you.
The detective was beaming. Okay, Lieutenant. Do that. I'd really like that. They had exited the campus front gates, taken a right, and then left on Prospect Street, and had arrived at the residence hall and parked. Karras opened the door on his side partway, and looking back at the detective said,
Thanks for the ride.
Got out of the car, shut the car door, and leaning his forearms on the open window jamb said,
I'm sorry that I couldn't be of very much help. Oh, no, you were, said the detective. No, yes, thank you. In the meantime, I'll give a call about a film. I really will.
I'll look forward, said Karras.
You take care now. I will. And you too.
Karis pulled back from the car, straightened up, turned around, and was moving away when he'd heard,
"Oh, Father, wait!"
Karis turned and saw Kinderman emerging from the car and beckoning him to come to him. Karis did and met Kinderman on the sidewalk.
"Listen, Father, I forgot. Totally, completely slipped my mind about the card. You know the card with the writing in Latin on it? The one that was found in the church?"
"Yeah, the altar card, you mean.
Whatever. It's still around?"
"Oh, yeah, I've got it in my room, as a matter of fact. I was checking out the Latin, but I'm finished now."
"You want it?"
"Yes, it could show something.
May I have it?"
"Sure. Hold on, I'll go get it for you now."
"I'm obliged."
While Kinderman leaned back against the squad car and waited, the Jesuit went quickly to his ground floor room, found the card, placed it inside a manila envelope, came back out to the street, and handed the envelope to Kinderman.
"Here you go, Lieutenant." "Father, thank you," said Kinderman, as he lifted the envelope to his scrutiny. "There could be some fingerprints, I'm thinking."
Then he looked up at Karis with incipient dismay.
He said, "Oi, you've been handling the card, Kirk Douglas? Replaying your role in detective story? No gloves, your bare hands?"
"I plead guilty, I guess."
"And without an explanation."
Shaking his head and eyeing Karis dismally, the detective added,
"Father Brown, you are not."
"Never mind.
Maybe still we could find something from it."
Here he held up the envelope.
"Incidentally, you studied this, you say?"
Karis nodded.
"Yeah, I did." "And your conclusion? I await with bated breath."
"I couldn't say," Karis told him. "Couldn't say, except
whatever the motive was, hatred of Catholicism, maybe?
I don't know, who knows? But what's certain is the guy who did this is very deeply disturbed."
"How do you know it was a man?"
Karis shrugged and looked away, his gaze following a passing Gunther beer truck as it rumbled on the cobblestones of the street.
"Oh, well, I don't," he said. "And it couldn't be some teenage lout?"
"No, it couldn't." Karis turned to look at Kinderman again.
"It's the Latin," he said.
"The Latin?
Oh, you mean on the altar card?"
"Yes. The Latin is flawless, Lieutenant. And more than that, it's got a definite style that's extremely individual."
"That's so."
"Yes, that's so. It's... it's as if whoever wrote it can think in Latin."
"Can priests?" "Oh, come on," scoff. "Just answer the question, please, Father Paranoia."
Karis turned his stare back to Kinderman, and after a pause admitted, "Okay, yes, yes. There comes a point in our training when we do, at least the Jesuits and maybe a couple of the other orders. At Woodstock Seminary in Maryland, our philosophy courses are, well, they're taught in Latin."
"Why is that?"
"For precision of thought. It expresses nuances and subtle distinctions that English can't handle."
"Ah, I see."
Looking suddenly grave, his stare intense, the priest leaned his face in close to the detective's.
"Look, Lieutenant, can I tell you who I really think did it?" The detective's eyebrows furrowed with interest.
"Yes, who?"
"The Dominicans. Go pick on them."
Karis smiled, and as he turned and walked away, the detective called after him,
"I lied. You look like Sal Mineo."
Karis turned with a grin and a friendly wave, and then opened the door to the residence hall and entered, while outside on the sidewalk the detective stood motionless, speculatively staring as he murmured,
"He hums like a tuning fork held under the water."
For a few seconds more, he continued staring pensively at the residence entry door. And then abruptly he turned, and opening the right front door of the squad car, he slid into the passenger seat, closed the door, and told the driver,
Back to headquarters. Hurry. Break laws.
Karras's new quarters in the Jesuit residence hall was sparely furnished. Bookshelves built into one wall, a single bed, two comfortable chairs, plus a desk and a straight-backed wooden chair. On the desk was an early photo of his mother, and on the wall above his bed, in silent rebuke, hung a bronze-colored metal crucifix. For Karras, the narrow room was world enough. He cared little for possessions, only that those he had be clean. He showered, scrubbing briskly, slipped on a white t-shirt and khaki chinos, then ambled to dinner in the priest's refectory, where he spotted pink-cheeked Dyer. Wearing a faded Snoopy sweatshirt, Dyer was sitting alone at a table in a corner. Karras moved to join him. Hey, hi, Damien.
Hey, Joe.
Standing in front of his chair, Karras blessed himself and closed his eyes, while inaudibly murmuring a rapid grace, then sat down at the table and spread a napkin on his lap. So how's the loafer? Dyer asked him.
What do you mean, loafer? I'm working.
One lecture a week?
It's the quality that counts.
What's dinner?
Can't you smell it?
Karras grimaced. Oh, hell is it. Dog day, knockwurst, and sauerkraut.
It's the quantity that counts, said Dyer.
Then as Karras reached out for a pitcher of milk, the young fey priest quietly warned,
I wouldn't do that,
while he buttered a slice of whole wheat bread.
See the bubbles, Damien?
Saltpeter. As Karras tipped up his glass to fill it, he heard the scrape of a chair as someone pulled it back and joined them at the table. Hey, I finally read that book, said the newcomer brightly. Karras glanced up and felt instant dismay, felt a soft, crushing weight, the press of lead, press of bone, as he recognized the young priest who had come to him recently for counseling, the one who could not make friends.
Owen, good, what did you think of it?
Karras asked, as if with interest. He set down the pitcher of milk, as if it were the booklet for a broken novena. The young priest talked, and half an hour later, Dyer was table-hopping, spiking the refectory with laughter. Karras checked his watch.
You want to pick up a jacket and walk across the street? He asked the young priest.
I like to watch the sunset every night if I can. Soon they were leaning against the railing at the top of the steps that plunged steeply down to M Street. End of day. The burnished rays of the setting sun flamed glory on the clouds of the western sky before shattering in gold and vermilion dapples on the darkening waters of the river. Once Karras met God in this sight, long ago. Like a lover forsaken, he still kept the rendezvous. Drinking it in, the young priest said, Oh, yes, yeah, so beautiful, really.
Yeah, it is.
The campus tower clock boomed out the hour. 7 p.m. At 7:23, Lieutenant Kinderman was pondering a spectrographic analysis showing that the paint from Reagan's sculpture matched a scraping of paint from the desecrated statue of the Virgin Mary. And at 8:47, in a slum in the northeast section of the city, an impassive Carl Engstrom emerged from a rat-infested tenement building, walked 3 blocks south to a bus stop where he waited alone for a minute, expressionless, then clutched at a lamppost with both his hands as he crumpled against it, racked with tears. At the time, Lieutenant Kinderman was at the movies.
Chapter 6.
On Wednesday, May 11th, they were back in the house. They put Reagan to bed, installed a lock on the shutters, And as they were stripping all the mirrors from her bedroom and bathroom, Chris recollected the final summary of the Barringer Clinic psychiatrist. Fewer and fewer lucid moments, Ms. McNeil. And now there's a total blacking out of her consciousness during the fits, I'm afraid. Now that's new and would seem to eliminate genuine hysteria. In the meantime, a symptom or two in the area of what we call parapsychic phenomena have... Dr. Klein came by and Chris attended with Sharon as he drilled them in proper procedures for administering sustenance feedings to Reagan during her periods of coma. He inserted the nasogastric tubing. "First," he said. Chris forced herself to watch, and yet still not see her daughter's face, to grip at the words that the doctor was saying and push away the others that she'd heard at the clinic. "Now, you stated no religion here, Miss McNeil. Is that right? No religious education at all?" "Oh, maybe just God, you know, general." "Why?" "Well, for one thing, the content of much of her raving, when it isn't that gibberish she's been spouting, well, it's religiously oriented. Now, where do you think she might have gotten that?" "Well, first give me a for instance." "Okay, then. Jesus and Mary, 69, for example?" Klein had guided the tubing into Reagan's stomach. "First, you check to see if fluid's gotten into her lungs," he instructed, pinching on the tube in order to clamp off the flow of sustagen. "It's a syndrome of a type of disorder, Ms. McNeil, that you rarely ever see anymore, except among primitive cultures. We call it somnambuliform possession. Now, quite frankly, we don't know much about it, except that it starts with some conflict or guilt that eventually leads to the patient's delusion that his body's been invaded by an alien intelligence, or a spirit, if you will. And times gone by, when belief in the devil was fairly strong, the possessing entity was usually a demon. In relatively modern cases, though, it's mostly the spirit of someone dead, very often someone the patient has known or seen and is able unconsciously to mimic as to the voice and the mannerisms, even the features of the face at rare times. After a gloomy Dr. Klein had left the house, Chris telephoned her agent in Beverly Hills and announced to him lifelessly that she definitely would not be directing Hope. Then she called Mrs. Perrin. She was out. Chris hung up the phone with a mounting dread. Who was it who could help her? She desperately wondered. Was there anyone? Anything? What? Cases where it's spirits of the dead are easier to deal with. You don't find the rages in most of those cases, or the hyperactivity and the motor excitement. However, in the other main type of somnambuliform possession, the new personality is always malevolent, always hostile toward the first. Its primary aim, in fact, is to damage and sometimes even kill it. A set of restraining straps had been delivered to the Prospect Street house, and Chris stood watching, wan and spent, while Carl affixed them, first to Reagan's bed, and then to her wrists. As Chris moved the pillow in an effort to center it under Reagan's head, the Swiss straightened up and looked pityingly at the child's ravaged face. "She is going to be well?" Chris didn't answer. As Carl was speaking, she had slipped out an object from under Reagan's pillow and was holding it up to her mystified gaze. Then her glance flicked to Carl as she snapped at him sternly. "Calhoun to help with this crucifix here?" "The syndrome is only a manifestation of some conflict, of some guilt. So we try to get at it, find out what it is. Well, the best procedure in a case like this is hypnotherapy. However, we can't seem to put her under. So then we took a shot at narcosynthesis. But it looks like another dead end. Fine. So what's next? Mostly time. We'll just have to keep trying and hoping there's a change. In the meantime, she is going to have to be hospitalized. Chris found Sharon in the kitchen, setting up a typewriter on the table. She had just brought it up from the basement playroom. Willie sliced carrots in the sink for a stew. With a current of tension and strain in her voice, Chris asked, "Was it you who put the crucifix under her pillow, Cher?" Sharon looked befuddled. "What do you mean, Chris? You didn't?" "Chris, I don't even know what you're talking about. Look, I told you before, Chris. I told you on the plane. All I've ever said about religion to rags is stuff like God made the world and maybe things about..." "Fine, Sharon, fine. I believe you, but..." "Me, I don't put it," growled Willie defensively, interrupting. "God damn it, somebody put it there!" Chris wheeled on Carl, who had just entered the kitchen and opened the refrigerator door. "Carl!" she called out to him sharply. "Yes, madam," Carl answered her calmly without turning around. He was folding ice cubes into a face towel. "Well, I'm asking you one more time," Chris said grittily, her voice cracking and at the edge of shrillness. "Did you put that freaking crucifix under Reagan's pillow?" "No, madam, not me. I don't do it," Carl answered as he plopped another ice cube into the towel.
"That fucking cross didn't just walk up there, goddammit!" Chris shrieked as she spun around to Willie and Sharon. "Now which one of you is lying to me?"
Carl stopped what he was doing and turned to study Chris. Her sudden rage had stunned the room, and now abruptly she slumped down into a chair, convulsively sobbing into trembling hands. "Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm doing. Oh, my God, I don't know." While Willie and Carl stood silently watching, Sharon came up behind Chris and started kneading her neck and shoulders with comforting hands. "Hey, okay. Okay, Chris. It's okay." Chris wiped at her face with the back of his sleeve. "Yeah. Yeah, I guess whoever did it..." She found a handkerchief in a pocket and blew her nose and then continued. "Whoever did it was only trying to help, I guess."
"Look, I'm telling you again, and you'd better believe it, all of you doctors, I am not about to put her into an asylum." "Ma'am, it isn't..."
"I don't care what the hell you call it. No way, I am not letting her out of my sight."
"Ma'am, I am all so sorry. We all are..." "Yes, sure. 88 doctors, Jesus Christ, with all of it." Chris tore the cellophane off a blue packet of Galois Blondes, an imported French cigarette, took a few deep puffs, and then tamped it out rapidly in an ashtray and went upstairs to look in on Reagan. When she opened the door and the gloom of the bedroom, she made out a male figure by Reagan's bedside, sitting in a straight-backed wooden chair, his arm outstretched and his hand over Reagan's brow. Chris moved closer. It was Carl. When Chris reached the bedside, he neither looked up at her, nor did he speak, but kept his gaze intently on the child's face. There was something in the hand on Reagan's brow. What was it? Then she saw it was an improvised ice pack. Surprised and touched, Chris appraised the stolid Swiss with a look of fondness that she had long ago misplaced. But when he neither moved nor acknowledged her presence, she turned away and quietly left the room. She went down to the kitchen, sat in the breakfast nook, drank coffee, and stared off distantly in thought until, on a sudden impulse, she stood up and walked briskly toward the cherrywood-paneled study. Once again, Chris's thoughts had drifted back to the words of the Barringer Clinic psychiatrist. Possession is loosely related to hysteria, insofar as the origin of the syndrome is almost always autosuggestive. Your daughter might have known about possession, believed in possession, and possibly known about some of its symptoms, so that now her unconscious is producing the syndrome. You following me, ma'am? Now, if that can be firmly established, and you still won't agree to hospitalization, you might just want to take a stab at something that I'm going to suggest. It has only an outside chance of a cure, I think, but still, it's a chance. Well, for God's sake, name it. What is it? Have you ever heard of exorcism, Mrs. McNeil? Chris was unfamiliar with the books in the study. They were part of the furnishings that came with the house. And now she was carefully scanning the titles. It's a stylized ritual pretty much out of date, in which rabbis and priests tried to drive out an evil spirit, well, so-called. It's only the Catholics who haven't discarded it yet, but they keep it pretty much in the closet as a sort of an embarrassment, I think. But to someone who really thinks he's possessed, I'd have to say that the ritual's pretty impressive. And it used to work, in fact, although not for the reason that they thought. No, of course not. It was purely the force of suggestion. The victim's belief in possession helped cause it. And in just the same way, his belief in the power of the exorcism can make it disappear. Oh, I see you frowning. Well, of course, I know it sounds pretty far-fetched. Well, then let me tell you something similar that we know to be a fact. It has to do with Australian Aborigines. They're convinced that if some wizard thinks a death ray at them from a distance, why, they're definitely going to die. And you know what? They do. They just lie down and slowly die. And the only thing that saves them most times is a similar form of suggestion, a counteracting ray by another wizard. Are you telling me to take my daughter to a witch doctor? As a last-ditch desperate measure? Well, yes. Yes? I suppose that I'm saying exactly that. Take her to a Catholic priest. That's a rather bizarre little piece of advice, I know, and honestly, maybe even a little bit dangerous, unless we can definitely ascertain whether or not your daughter knew anything at all about possession, and particularly exorcism, before any of her symptoms came on. Do you think she might have read it somewhere? No. Seen a movie about it, something on the radio, TV? No. Read the Gospels, maybe? The New Testament? No, she hasn't. Why are you asking? There are quite a few accounts of possession in them and of exorcisms by Christ. The descriptions of the symptoms, in fact, are the same as in possession today. So, look, I'm sorry, it's just no good, okay? Just forget it. That's all I need is to have a father here. I called in a... Chris's fingertips moved from book to book, searching, but so far finding nothing until... Hey, hold it. Her eyes darted quickly back to a title on the bottom shelf. It was the book about witchcraft that Mary Jo Perrin had sent to her. Chris plucked it out and turned quickly to the table of contents, running her thumbnail slowly down the list until, abruptly, she stopped and thought, there it is. Soft thrills of surmise rippled through her. The doctors at Barringer right after all? Was this it? Had Reagan plucked her disorder and her symptoms through auto-suggestion from the pages of this book? The title of a chapter was States of Possession. Chris walked to the kitchen where Sharon was seated, reading her shorthand from a propped-up notepad while typing a letter. Chris held up the book. "Have you ever read this, Sharon?" Still typing, Sharon asked, "Read what?" "Look at me. This book about witchcraft." Sharon stopped typing, turned a glance to Chris and the book, and said, "No, Chris, I haven't." She turned back to her work. "You've never seen it, Sharon? You never put it on a bookshelf in the study?" "No." "Where's Willie, Sharon?" "At the market." Chris nodded and stood silently pondering, then went back upstairs to Reagan's bedroom, where Carl still kept vigil at her daughter's side. "Carl?"
"Yes, madam."
Chris held up the book. "By any chance, did you find this lying around and then put it with the rest of the books in the study?" The houseman turned to Chris, expressionless, shifted his gaze to the book and then back to her.
"No, madam," he said. "Not me."
Then he turned his gaze back to Reagan. "Okay, then," Chris thought. "Maybe Willie." Chris returned to the kitchen, sat down at the table, and, opening the book to the chapter on possession, she began to search for anything relevant, anything that doctors at Barringer Clinic thought might have given rise to Reagan's symptoms. And found it. Immediately derivative of the prevalent belief in demons was the phenomenon known as possession, a state in which many individuals believed that their physical and mental functions had been invaded and were being controlled by either a demon, most common in the period under discussion, or the spirit of someone dead. There is no period of history or quarter of the globe where this phenomenon has not been reported, and in fairly constant terms, and yet it is still to be adequately explained. Since Traugott Oesterreich's definitive study, first published in 1921, very little has been added to the body of knowledge, the advances of psychiatry notwithstanding. Chris frowned. Not fully explained? She'd had a different impression from the doctors at Barringer. She continued to read. What is known is the following: that various people at various times have undergone massive transformations so complete that those around them feel they are dealing with another person. Not only the voice, the mannerisms, facial expressions, and characteristic movements are sometimes altered, but the subject himself now thinks of himself as totally distinct from the original person and as having a name, whether human or demonic, and a separate history of its own. In the Malay archipelago, where possession even now is an everyday common occurrence, the possessing spirit of someone dead often causes the possessed to mimic its gestures, voice, and mannerisms so strikingly that relatives of the deceased will burst into tears. But aside from so-called quasi-possession, those cases are ultimately reduced to fraud, paranoia, and hysteria. The problem has always lain with interpreting the phenomena, the oldest interpretation being the spiritist, an impression that is likely to be strengthened by the fact that the intruding personality may have accomplishments quite foreign to the first. In the demoniacal form of possession, for example, the demon may speak in languages unknown to the first personality. There, Chris thought. Reagan's gibberish. An attempt at a language? Chris read on quickly. Or manifest parapsychic phenomena, such as telekinesis, for example, the movement of objects without application of material force. The rappings, thought Chris. The flingings up and down on the bed. In cases of possession by the dead, there are manifestations such as Oesterreich's account of a monk who, abruptly, while possessed, became a gifted and brilliant dancer, although he had never, before his possession, had occasion to dance so much as a step. So impressive at times are these manifestations that Jung, the psychiatrist, after studying a case at first hand, could offer only partial explanation for what he was certain could not have been fraud. Chris frowned. The tone of this was worrisome. "And William James," she read on, "the greatest psychologist that America has ever produced, resorted to positing the plausibility of the spiritualist interpretation of the phenomenon after closely studying the so-called Watsika wonder, a teenage girl in Watsika, Illinois, who became indistinguishable in personality from a girl named Mary Roth, who had died in a state insane asylum 12 years prior to the possession." Riveted, Chris did not hear the doorbell chime, did not hear Sharon stop typing and go to the door. The demoniacal form of possession is usually thought to have its origin in early Christianity. Yet in fact, both possession and exorcism predate the time of Christ. The ancient Egyptians, as well as the earlier civilizations of the Tigris and the Euphrates, believed that physical and spiritual disorders were caused by invasion of the body by demons. The following, for example, is the formula for exorcism against maladies of children in ancient Egypt. "Go hence, thou who comest in darkness, whose nose is turned backwards, whose face is upside down. Hast thou come to kiss this child? I will not let thee." "Chris?" "Sharon, busy." "Chris says a homicide detective wants to see you." "Oh, Christ, Sharon, tell—" Abruptly, Chris stopped, then looked up and said, Oh, yeah. "Yeah, sure, Sharon. Tell him to come in. Let him in." Sharon left, and Chris stared at the pages of the book, unseeing, gripped by some formless yet gathering premonition of dread. Sound of a door being closed. Sound of walking this way. A sense of waiting. Waiting. Waiting for what? Like the vivid dream one can never remember, Chris felt an expectancy that seemed known and yet undefined. His hat brim crumpled in his hands. He came in with Sharon, wheezing and listing and deferential. "Oh, I am really so sorry," Kinderman said as he approached. "Yes, you're busy, I can see that, I'm a bother." "So how's the world?" Chris asked him. "Oh, very bad." "How's your daughter?" "No change." "Oh, I'm so sorry." Breathing out annoyedly, Kinderman was standing by the table now, his drooping beagle eyes moist with concern. "Look, I wouldn't even bother. I mean your daughter. It's a worry. God knows when my little girl Julie was down with the... What now? What was it? I can't remember it." "Why don't you sit down?" Chris cut in. Oh yes, thank you very much," the detective exhaled gratefully, while settling his bulk in a chair across from Sharon, who, seemingly oblivious, continued to type. "So I'm sorry, Lieutenant, you were saying?" "Well, my daughter, she..." "Ah, no, never mind. I get started, I'll be telling you my whole life story. You could maybe make a film of it." "No, really? It's incredible. If you only knew half the crazy things that used to happen in my family, you..." No, never mind. "All right, one. I'll tell one. like my mother, every Friday she would make us gefilte fish, all right? Only all week long, the whole week, no one gets to take a bath on account of my mother has the carp in the bathtub. It's swimming back and forth, because my mother said this cleaned out the poison in its system. I mean, really, who knew? Who knew the carp the whole time of thinking these horrible and evil, vindictive thoughts? Oh, well, enough. I'm really sorry. Only now and then a laugh, you know, just to keep us from crying." Chris studied him, waiting. "Are you reading?" The detective was looking down at the book on witchcraft. For a film? No, just passing the time.
Is it good?
I don't know. I just started it. Witchcraft, Kinderman murmured. His head angled to the side as he read the book's title at the top of a page. So, K-Dow, Lieutenant, what's doing? Chris asked.
Ah, yes, I'm sorry. You're busy. I'll finish. Now, as I said, I wouldn't bother you except... Except what?
Looking suddenly grave, the detective clasped his hands together on the polished pine tabletop. Well, it seems that Burke...
Damn it! Snapped Sharon irritably, as she ripped out a letter from the platen of the typewriter,
crumpled it up in her hands, and then errantly tossed it into a waste paper basket close to Kinderman's feet. He and Chris had turned their heads to stare at her, and when the secretary saw them, she said,
Oh, I'm so sorry. God, I didn't even know you were there.
You're Miss Fenster? Asked Kinderman. Spencer, Sharon corrected him, as she slid her chair back and got up to retrieve the balled-up letter from the floor with a murmured,
I never said I was Julius Irving.
Never mind, never mind, the detective told her, as reaching to the floor near his foot, he picked up the crumpled page. Oh, thanks, Sharon stopped and went back to her chair.
Excuse me, you're the secretary? Kinderman asked her.
Oh, Sharon, this is... Chris turned to Kinderman. Sorry, she said to him. Your name again?
Kinderman. William F. Kinderman.
This is Sharon, Sharon Spencer. With a courtly tilt and nod of the head, the detective told Sharon,
It's a pleasure.
Sharon was now bent forward, eyeing him curiously, her chin resting on folded arms atop the typewriter.
And perhaps you can help me, the detective added.
Her arms still folded, Sharon sat up and said,
Me?
Yes, maybe.
On the night of Mr. Denning's demise, you went out to a drugstore and you left him alone in the house, am I correct?
Well, not exactly. Reagan was here. That's my daughter, Chris clarified.
Spelling?
R-E-G-A-N, Chris told him.
Lovely name, said Kinderman.
Thank you. The detective turned back to Sharon.
Now, Dennings had come here that night to see Mrs. McNeil.
Yes, that's right.
He expected her shortly?
Well, yeah, I told him I expected her back pretty soon.
Good, very good. And you left at what time? You remember?
Let's see, I was watching the news, so I guess... Oh, no, wait. Yeah, that's right. I remember being bothered because the pharmacist said the delivery boy had gone home, and I said, oh, come on now, or something about it only being about 6:30. Then Burke came along just 10, maybe 20 minutes after that, at the most.
So a median, concluded the detective, would have put him here at 6:45. Not so?
And so what's this all about? Chris asked him.
The nebulous tension she'd been feeling had mounted. Well, it raises a question, Mrs. McNeil. To arrive at the house at, say, 6:45 and leave only 20 minutes later? Chris shrugged.
Oh, well, that was Burke, she said. Just like him.
Was it also like him, Kinderman asked, to frequent the bars down on M Street?
Bar? No, not at all.
Oh, no, no, not that I know of.
No, I thought not.
I made a little check. And so he wouldn't have had a reason to be at the top of those steps beside your house after leaving here that night.
And
was it also not his custom to travel by taxi?
Wouldn't call a cab from your house when he left? Well, yeah, he would.
Lacey always did. Then one wonders, not so, why or how he came to be there that night.
And one wonders why taxicab companies do not show a record of calls from this house on that night, except for the one that picked up your Miss Spencer here at precisely 6:47. Her voice drained of color, Chris said softly. I don't know.
No. I doubted that you would, the detective told her. In the meantime, the matter has now grown somewhat serious.
Chris was breathing shallowly. In what way?
The report of the pathologist, Kinderman recounted, seems to show that the chance that Dennings died accidentally is still very possible. However, are you saying he was murdered? Well, it seems that the position... Kinderman hesitated. I'm sorry, he said. This will be painful.
Go ahead.
The position of Dennings' head and the certain shearing of the muscles of the neck would... Shutting her eyes, Chris winced and said, Oh, God. Yes, as I said, it's very painful. I'm so sorry, really. But you see, this condition, I think we can skip the details, perhaps.
It never could happen unless Mr. Dennings had fallen some distance before he hit the steps. For example, maybe 20-30 feet before he went rolling down to the bottom. So a clear possibility, plainly speaking, is that maybe...
Kinderman turned to Sharon. Arms folded across her chest, she had been listening, mesmerized, wide-eyed.
Well, now first let me ask you something, Miss Spencer. When you left, he was where, Mr. Dennings?
With the child?
No, he was down here in the study, fixing a drink.
Ah, might your daughter remember, he turned to Chris,
if perhaps Mr. Dennings was in her room that night?
Why do you ask?
Might your daughter remember? How could she? Like I told you, she was heavily sedated and...
Yes, yes, you did tell me. That's true, I recall it. But perhaps she awakened.
Well, she didn't, Chris told him.
She was also sedated when last we spoke?
Yes, she was. I thought I saw her at her window that day.
Well, you're mistaken.
Could be.
Yes, perhaps so. I'm just not sure.
Listen, why are you asking me all this?
Well, a clear possibility, as I was saying, is maybe the deceased was so drunk that he stumbled and fell from the window in your daughter's bedroom.
Not so? No way. In the first place, that window was always closed, and besides, Burke was always drunk, but he never got sloppy. Jesus, Burke used to direct when he was drunk. Now, how could he stumble and fall out a window?
Or you may be expecting someone else here that night.
Someone else? No, I wasn't.
Have you friends who drop by without calling?
Only Burke. The detective lowered his head and shook it.
So strange, he breathed out wearily. Baffling.
Then he lifted his glance to Chris.
The deceased comes to visit, stays only 20 minutes without even seeing you, and leaves all alone here, a very sick girl. And speaking plainly, as you yourself would say, it's not likely he would fall from a window. Besides, a fall wouldn't do to his neck, what we found, except maybe a chance in 100, in 1,000.
He motioned with his head at the witchcraft book. You've read
in that book about ritual murder? Her chill prescience mounting, Chris quietly said. No.
Well, maybe not in that book. However,
forgive me, I mention this only so maybe you'll think just a little bit harder. Poor Mr. Dennings was discovered with his head wrenched around in the style of ritual murder by so-called demons, Mrs. McNeil.
Chris's complexion visibly paled.
Some lunatic killed Mr. Dennings and...
Kinderman halted. Something wrong? He asked.
He had noticed the tension in her eyes, her sudden pallor.
No, nothing. Nothing's wrong. Go ahead.
I'm obliged.
Now, at first, I never told you to spare you the hurt. And besides, it could technically still be an accident. But me, I don't think so. My hunch, my opinion, I believe he was killed by a powerful man, point one. And the fracturing of his skull, point two, plus the various things I have mentioned would make it very probable. Probable, not certain. Your director was killed and then afterward pushed from your daughter's window. But no one was here except your daughter. So then how could this be? Well, it could be one way. If someone came calling between the time Miss Spencer left and the time you returned, not so? Now I ask you again, please. Who might have come? Chris lowered her head. Oh, Judas Priest, just a second. Yes, I'm sorry, it's painful. And perhaps I'm all wrong, but you'll think now. Who might have come, please? Head still lowered. Chris frowned and thought for a time, then looked up. No. No, I'm sorry. There's just no one I can think of. Kinderman turned his glance to Sharon. Maybe you then, Miss Spencer? Someone comes here to see you? Oh, no, no one. Does the horseman know where you work? Chris asked her. Kinderman's eyebrows rose. The horseman? Sharon's boyfriend, Chris explained. Sharon shook her head. Oh, he's never come here, she said. Besides, he was in Boston that night at some convention. Oh, he's a salesman, asked Kinderman. No, he's a lawyer. Ah. The detective turned back to Chris. The servants, they have visitors? No, never. Not ever at all. You expected a package that day, some delivery? Why? Mr. Dennings was, not to speak ill of the dead. But as you said, in his cups, he was somewhat, well, let's call it irascible, and capable, doubtless, of provoking an argument or an anger, and, in this case, maybe even a rage from perhaps some delivery person who'd come by with a package. So, were you expecting something? Dry cleaning, maybe, groceries, liquor, a package? I wouldn't know. Carl handles all of that. Ah, right, of course. If you want to ask him, go ahead. The detective sighed morosely. Leaning back from the table, he stuffed his hands into the pockets of his coat as he cast a glum look at the witchcraft book. Never mind. It's remote. You've got a daughter very sick and... Well, enough now. He made a gesture of dismissal. That's it. End of meeting. He stood up. Thank you for your time, he said to Chris, and then to Sharon. Very nice to have met you, Miss Spencer. Same here, Sharon answered remotely. She was staring into space. Baffling, said Kinderman with a head shake. So strange. So very strange. He was focused on some inner thought. Then he looked up at Chris as she rose from her chair. Well, I'm sorry I bothered you for nothing, he said. Here, I'll walk you to the door, Chris told him. Both her expression and her voice were subdued. Oh, no, please don't bother. No, it's no bother at all. If you insist. Oh, incidentally, the detective said, as he and Chris were moving out of the kitchen. Just a chance in a million, I know, but your daughter. You could ask her if she possibly saw Mr. Dennings in her room that night. Look, he wouldn't have had a reason to be up there in the first place. Yes, I know that. I realize that's true. But if certain British doctors had never asked, what's this fungus, we wouldn't today have penicillin. Am I right? Please ask. You'll ask? Well, when she's well enough, yeah, I'll ask. Couldn't hurt. They had arrived at the home's front door. In the meantime, the detective continued. But he faltered, and touching two fingertips to his lips, he said gravely. Look, I hate to be asking you this. Please forgive me. Expecting some new shock, Chris tensed and felt that prescience tingling again in her bloodstream. She said, what? For my daughter. You could maybe give an autograph. The detective's cheeks had reddened. After a moment of surprise, Chris almost laughed with relief at herself and at despair in the human condition. Of course. Where's a pen? Right here, responded Kinderman instantly, whipping out a pen from the pocket of his coat, while his other hand dipped into a pocket of his jacket and slipped out a calling card. He handed them to Chris. Oh, she would love it. What's her name? Chris asked, pressing the card against the door as she held the pen poised to write. A weighty hesitation followed, as from behind her she heard only wheezing. She glanced around, and in Kinderman's eyes and reddening face, she saw the tension of some massive inner struggle.
I lied, he said finally, his eyes at once desperate and defiant. The autograph's for me. Write to William, William F. Kinderman. It's spelled on the back. Chris eyed him with a wan and unexpected affection, checked the spelling of his name, and wrote William F. Kinderman. I love you, Chris McNeil. And then gave him the card, which he tucked into his pocket without reading the inscription. You're a very nice lady, he said to Chris sheepishly. Thanks. You're a very nice man. He seemed to blush harder. No, I'm not. I'm a bother. He was opening the door. Look, never mind what I said here today. All right, forget it. Keep your mind on your daughter. Your daughter. Chris nodded, her despondency returning as Kinderman stepped out onto a wide and low, black iron-gated stoop. He turned around and, in the daylight, was more conscious of the dark sacks beneath the movie star's eyes. He donned his hat. But you'll ask her, he reminded. I will, she said. I promise. Well then, goodbye, and take care. You too. Chris shut the door and leaned back against it, closing her eyes, then almost instantly opened them again as she heard the chiming of the doorbell. She turned and opened the door, revealing Kinderman. He grimaced in apology. I'm a nuisance. I am so sorry. I forgot my pen. Chris looked down and saw the pen still in her hand. She smiled faintly and handed it to the detective. And another thing, he said. Yes, it's pointless. I know that. I'm sorry. I won't sleep tonight thinking maybe there's a lunatic loose or a doper if every little point I don't cover. Do you think I could... No, it's dumb. It's a... Yes, forgive me, but I think I really should. Could I maybe have a word with Mr. Engstrom, do you think? It's the deliveries, the question of deliveries. Chris opened the door wider. Yeah, sure, come on in. You can talk to him in the study. Oh, no, you're busy. No, you're very kind, but enough already. I can talk to him here. This is fine. Here, fine. He'd leaned back and was resting on the stoop's iron railing. If you insist, Chris told him, smiling faintly. I think he's upstairs with Reagan. I'll send him right down. I'm obliged. Chris closed the door, and not long after, Carl opened it. He stepped down to the stoop with his hand on the door.